Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Monday, December 6th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Looking at the headline for weather this morning, windy and colder today, a few snow showers possible tomorrow. Cedar Rapids. Strong wind is the big issue today, with gusts over 50 miles per hour possible early on. The wind will slowly subside later this afternoon, and especially by tonight. Temperatures will fall into the 20s for highs, along with wind chills in the 5 to 15 degree range. Tonight into tomorrow, a weak system is still on track to bring us a chance of some snow. Right now, any accumulations look very minor, and this system shouldn't cause too many issues around here. We'll continue to watch the trends as it comes our way. By later this week, temperatures warm up a bit in response to increasing moisture, which may lead to a chance of rain or snow by the time we get to Thursday and Friday. Highs will then fall to the 30s to start the weekend. Our stories on the front page include Hungry Charlie's opens in downtown Waterloo, Living with Long-Haul COVID-19, and we begin reading Nursing Home Among the Worst. Iowa Care Facility Among the Nation's Worst now faces $685,000 in fines. Story filed by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Fort Dodge, an Iowa nursing home cited for regulatory violations that contributed to abuse, neglect, and the death of a resident, has been added to a federal list of the nation's worst care facilities and fined more than $500,000. The QHC Fort Dodge Villa in Webster County was cited in October for 18 federal regulatory violations and 4 state violations. The facility was recently added to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Special Focus Facility List, which is a national list of care facilities with some of the worst records of regulatory compliance. The Fort Dodge home, which has about 75 residents, now has the lowest possible overall rating from CMS, which evaluates care facilities' performance based on inspectors' findings, staffing levels, and quality of care. It is one of 2 special focus facilities in Iowa that are run by QHC Management of Clive, a company owned by Jerry and Nancy Voynia. Officials at QHC Management said Friday that owner Nancy Voynia was not available for comment. QHC Management operates 8 nursing homes and 2 assisted living facilities that provide care for about 500 Iowans. As a result of issues uncovered by state inspectors this past summer, the Fort Dodge home has been hit with federal fines for each day it has remained out of compliance with minimum health care standards. The daily fines, which once were accruing at almost $9,000 per day, so far totaled $685,740. State officials said Friday the final fine won't be determined until the facility comes into substantial compliance with all government regulations. In August, state inspectors visited the Fort Dodge home and subsequently issued a 199-page inspection report listing all of the regulatory violations found at the facility. Among the violations were failure to respect residents' rights, failure to provide a safe, clean environment, failure to provide quality care, failure to prevent or treat pressure sores, and failure to ensure residents are free of medication errors. Also, failure to employ sufficient nursing staff, failure to adequately prevent and control infections, failure to provide adequate COVID-19 testing and screening, failure to keep the home free of accident hazards, and failure to employ competent nursing staff. The inspection was triggered by 10 complaints to the state inspector's agency, all of which were substantiated. Among the problems alleged by inspectors were resident death. On June 27th, a resident of the home fell and struck his head. According to an aide who witnessed the fall, a nurse was nearby on her phone and did nothing to assist the resident and continued to talk on her phone even after the fall. Another aide interviewed about the fall told inspectors, quote, the facility is a mess, unquote, compared to others she's worked in, and that the nurses don't care when resident issues are reported to them. Although the resident who fell immediately complained of pain, no pain medications were given for 22 hours, and there were no indication of a complete assessment of the injury being performed. Shortly after the fall, the resident screamed out in pain and could be heard as far as approximately 200 feet away when he was repositioned in bed, inspectors reported. The resident screamed, cried, and begged for God to take his life, the inspectors found. On July 2nd, 5 days after the fall, the resident died. A staff nurse who saw the resident that day later told inspectors the man's hip was rotated all the way to his buttock, and one leg was significantly shorter, adding that the man's condition would have been obvious to anyone who had performed an assessment. Neglect. On August 23rd, a resident was admitted to the home after surgical repair of an opened compound fracture of his left ankle. The resident told inspectors that he waited more than an hour for assistance from the staff to get into bed. During that time, he said, he watched the staff congregate at the nurse's station using their phones and laughing. When he attempted to put himself into bed, his wheelchair slid out from under him and he fell to the floor, then crawled to the bed and climbed in. None of the staff came to his assistance or evaluated his injuries, he said. Another resident of the home told inspectors she fell on August 30th while attempting to get into a taxi at the facility for a trip to a bank. She said the staff saw her fall, but was instructed not to help her, so she crawled across the parking lot and got into the taxi. Physical abuse. A medication aide told inspectors she saw one resident of the home punch another resident while a group of nurses sat nearby using their phones. The aide said she had to threaten to call the state before her co-workers agreed to check the resident who was attacked. Another employee told inspectors that a nurse immediately assisted the resident. Verbal abuse. A medication aide at the home backed up a resident's complaint about two workers who were accused of bullying residents of the home. The aide said the two were verbally abusive to one resident, saying things such as, quote, you are going to do this right now, or it's not going to happen for you at all, and spoke in vulgar, blunt tones. COVID-19 screening. A dietary aide told inspectors she had a problem breathing through her COVID-19 mask, so she typically placed it below her nose. She also reported that had never had her temperature checked prior to working and had never been asked any questions about signs or symptoms of COVID-19 prior to entering the facility and serving food and drinks to residents. Another dietary aide was seen by inspectors eating in the dining room alongside two unmasked residents with her mask pulled down below her chin. Inspectors watched as two nurses' aides entered a resident's room with their masks pulled down. Later that day, another worker entered the building without being screened for COVID-19 and walked into the building with her mask below her nose. The home was also cited for failing to employ an infection prevention specialist as required. COVID-19 testing. The home was cited for failing to maintain records of COVID-19 testing prior to July 13th of this year and for repeatedly failing to test dozens of residents after positive COVID-19 cases were confirmed at the facility. Resident discharge. The facility was cited for discharging a resident against medical advice without first making referrals to ensure someone would follow up with the man once he left the home and was in the community. The nurse aide told inspectors that about a week after the man was discharged, she was driving to work and saw the man on the street where he flagged her down. She turned around and gave the man money to eat, later reporting that the man's clothing was drenched in urine and soiled with feces, and his motorized scooter was about to stop working. Quote, it was horrible to see him like that. He was definitely in the same clothes, the aide told inspectors. Quote, when he was at the facility, he was my favorite, respectful, never really did anything, I miss him, unquote. Medication errors. The home failed to give one resident 4 doses of prescribed medications for hypertension, a condition that increases the risk of stroke and heart attacks. The resident was rushed to the hospital after complaining of chest pain and became unresponsive. The resident was admitted to the hospital and diagnosed as having had a heart attack. Residents writes, inspectors noted that an infestation of bedbugs resulted in the staff throwing away one resident's new leather recliner, which was not the source of the bugs. Staffing levels. The home was cited for employing a director of nursing who often worked as a floor nurse, limiting her ability to oversee the staff. The director of nursing had worked 756 hours in 1 3-month period, an average of 63 hours per week. Tuberculosis testing. The home's administrator told inspectors the facility didn't have any new physicals or tuberculosis tests for employees, adding that she wondered if the staff had stopped doing them once the company stopped giving pay raises. QHC Fort Dodge Villa is now the nation's special focused facilities list. Typically, homes that are eligible for a special focus designation have about twice the average number of violations cited by state inspectors. They have more serious problems than most other nursing homes, including harm or injury to residents, and they have established a pattern of serious problems that has persisted over a long period of time. The special focus facility list is updated quarterly by CMS and includes homes deemed by CMS to have a history of serious quality issues. Those homes are enrolled in a special program intended to stimulate improvements in their quality of care through increased oversight. While 10 Iowa homes are deemed eligible for that sort of assistance, they are not actually enrolled in the program or receiving the assistance. That's because the number of facilities on the list remains relatively constant. New facilities can't be named a special focus facility, regardless of how poor their care is, until other homes in that same state improve or graduate from the list, a process that can take 4 years or more. Nationally, there are normally about 88 nursing facilities on the list, with 1 or 2 slots to be filled by each state. The only Iowa homes now designated as special focus facilities are both run by QHC Management of Des Moines, with QHC Winterset North having been on the list for 12 months. According to CMS, the Winterset home remains on the list because it has not yet shown any improvement. A third QHC home in Mitchellville is on the list of homes eligible for special focus status due to its history of care issues. The next story comes to us from Iowa Watch, and the journalist is Lyle Muller. It's titled, Living with Long Haul COVID-19. More than a year later, exhaustion reigns for COVID-19 long hauler, Iowa City. The migraines, exhaustion, and shortness of breath have existed dating to before Darcy Harvel Studevant was diagnosed with COVID-19 in April 2020. The shortness of breath has improved a bit, but the rest remain going into the summer holiday season. So do the dizziness and confusion. Quote, most days I'm extremely exhausted and tired, and it's hard to even do anything throughout the day, Harvel Studevant, 34, of Iowa City, said. Harvel Studevant is a long hauler, someone who could not shake the illness that the highly contagious COVID-19 creates, leaving them to suffer with symptoms long after they no longer test positive for the coronavirus. The medical term for this is long COVID syndrome. Studies show 1 of every 4 people who have COVID-19 suffers long-term effects. 1 in 10 healthcare workers who had mild COVID-19 was a long hauler in the study reported last April. Iowa Watch has followed Havel Sturdivant's post-COVID problems since first reporting about her in March. She said in a recent interview that her confusion is especially difficult. Quote, I go to one place and I get halfway there and I forget why I was going. Or like, if I were planning to go to Burger King, for example, I would end up at Hardee's or Wendy's, she said. Quote, you know, like, just everyday tasks have been 10 times harder because of that. Havel Sturdivant said she's taking medication ordinarily prescribed to people with Alzheimer's disease to help with her memory problems. Alzheimer's is not curable, but medication can change how the disease progresses in some patients. It is not connected to COVID-19. One of her doctors has recommended cognitive rehabilitation, she said, but she prefers staying home and taking medicines. Quote, with the COVID numbers, I've been really nervous about going out in public. You know, I've survived this once, and it's left me with all these problems. I just can't imagine if I got it again or brought it home to my family. So I'm trying to lay low, unquote. Havel Sturdivant and her husband, Gabe, have a 4-year-old daughter, Rain. Her elderly mother also lives with the family. COVID-19 affects multiple organs in the body, including the lungs, heart, eyes, liver, bladder, kidneys, pancreas, and brain, as well as the nasal passages. Fatigue is consistently reported problem for people with long COVID syndrome. The National Institutes of Health launched in September a Researching COVID to Enhance Recovery initiative. The program's goal is to understand what is happening biologically in people recovering from COVID-19 and develop clinical tests for possible solutions. Dr. Walter Korohetz, director of the NIH's National Institute on Neurological Disorders and Stroke, said at a November 17th NIHCM webinar. NIHCM is the nonprofit National Institute for Healthcare Management Foundation. Quote, the good news is we really have an army of people working on this problem now, Korohetz said. Quote, the basic science of fatigue will really help us now, I think, as we're facing the problem of the post-COVID situation. A group of medical professionals banding together as the COVID Patient Recovery Alliance has thrown its endorsement to the NIH efforts and making sure long haulers get help with their medical problems. Quote, we need community awareness so that people are experiencing these vague signs of fatigue or depression or sleeplessness can actually be channeled into the system. Dr. Brett Gior, distinguished visiting executive at the healthcare consulting firm Levitt Partners of Salt Lake City, said the NIHCM webinar. Iowa Watch attended the webinar virtually. Havel Sturdivant worked at University Hospitals in Iowa City as a unit clerk until having to give up the job late last year because she couldn't be there. At home, her family sees the suffering. Quote, I think that it's really hard to witness, she said. That especially is difficult for Rain, who will be 5 early next year. Quote, I think it's really hard because she wants to play with other kids, and she sees other kids and wants to interact with them. And we just have to, you know, remind her, like, keep your distance, wear your mask. You'll be able to play with them eventually. Quote, you know, this pandemic can't last forever, unquote. Havel Sturdivant and her husband canceled plans for a second year to have family for Thanksgiving because of the coronavirus still is being diagnosed, and there are predictions of a bad flu season ahead. Christmas is up in the air, depending on COVID-19 infection numbers for Iowa, she said. Quote, I'm sure others would say, you only live once and blah, 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 to justify the risk, but those people might not have experienced severe pneumonia and almost died within a few days, Havel Sturdivant wrote in an email the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. She was trying to get rid of a cold and helping a family member with some personal matters. Quote, I never want to not be able to breathe again, and so I'll safeguard, however I need to hopefully get through this pandemic and not be another statistic, unquote. The email was an example of being a realist, she said, which she has talked about in Iowa Watch interviews. That same realism leads her to think that long haulers should not expect a miracle cure to change their situations, she said. Quote, look at it as, I've got these symptoms going on. Find a particular doctor that handles those symptoms. Get tested. Try to see if you qualify for a diagnosis. and then go and find treatment for those diagnoses. Our next story was filed by Amy Rivers. Hungry Charlie's Lunchbox Deli is the newest sandwich shop in downtown Waterloo. Waterloo, a popular food truck, is now gobbling up its own storefront for a deli-style eatery in downtown Waterloo. Hungry Charlie's Lunchbox Deli has now taken up residence inside the former Here's What's Poppin' restaurant, previously the longtime Boardwalk Deli at 206 East 4th Street. They'll be serving gourmet paninis, pressed hoagies, pita flatbreads, specialty salads, hot dogs, soups, and more. It's a lot different from what fans of the Hungry Charlie's food truck are used to seeing on the menu. That's largely because without the infrastructure for a hood, owners Deli Corbett and Caddy Van Dyke Corbett can't fry or grill their truck's popular offerings of burgers, fries, tenderloins, and tacos. But the idea for their own standalone restaurant snowballed really fast, and the couple says they're ready to try something new, and ready for Cedar Valley to try their homemade sandwiches, salads, and soups. Quote, "We don't want to be another Subway, another Newton's," Katie said. "We want to give people something different." Hungry Charlie's, the food truck, began in 2020 after Daniel grew disillusioned with the way he was treated as a manager at a local steakhouse. Quote, "It wasn't actually a bad job. I just got to be a lot during the pandemic," he said. "They expected more and more, then laid everybody off, and all the managers worked open to close every day. That got Daniel thinking about his options, and when he found a food truck for sale in Davenport, Katie, also a longtime restaurant employee, said she was on board. Within a week, I decided I was going to buy a food truck. I bought a food truck and turned in my notice," Daniel said. Quote, "We figured we're not getting any younger. We might as well do it," unquote. They started parking the truck at Six Corners off the West 4th Street, then got an offer to start parking at Chaser's Pub, where the owners offered to provide power for their generator. That exposure led to events and festivals in other places like Charles City, Waverly, and LaPorte City. For Daniel, the biggest barrier to growth seems to be the imposter syndrome. Quote, "I personally don't think my food is very good," he said. "People say it is good, but we think it's just because people like us." Quote, he's like, "They just don't want to hurt my feelings," Katie laughed. But business was brisk. Daniel remembers weeks when they did 7 or 8 events, driving home late in the evening, to be up at the crack of dawn to make a farmer's market in the morning. They even earned an award at the inaugural food truck festival in Waterloo for their tacos. Quote, "In a year and a half, we've grown pretty well," he said, "and we've learned a lot of stuff from a lot of people. It's been pretty great," unquote. A few months ago, they found themselves having a conversation with downtown restaurant owners, as well as JSA Development, which offered a good deal on a lease, Daniel said. Quote, "Before you know it, we're signing on the dotted line," he said. It went from, "Hey, we'll buy some of the to-go containers that you don't want anymore," to us moving in, Katie said. Despite that windfall, the couple hopes to become a downtown staple, offering homemade meals at affordable prices, and they hope to keep the food truck going as well, provided they find the right people to help them run it. "The Cedar Valley has been so awesome to us. They really have," Katie said. "That's what I'm excited about, meeting new regulars." Quote, "We want to do good things for Waterloo," Daniel agreed. Quote, "Waterloo's done good things for us," unquote. And now we turn the page and find the regular Monday Northeast Iowa Escapades section. Here are a few of the events, shenanigans, and goings-on worth checking out this week in the Northeast Iowa area. On Tuesday, December 7th, Vince Gotera to share Coolest Month. On Tuesday, poet and author Vince Gotera will share his thoughts on The Coolest Month, a collection of poems written every day of the month of April and published in 2019. The Cedar Falls Authors Festival presentation begins at 7 p.m. at the Hearst Center for the Arts, 304 West Surly Boulevard, and is free and open to the public. On Wednesday, make your own Christmas cards at WCA. Sip a glass of wine and use a letterpress to make your own Christmas cards from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Wednesday at the Waterloo Center for the Arts, 225 Commercial Street, in partnership with Pretty Good Company. Cost is $24. Register at area code 319-291-4490 or waterloocenterforthearts.org. On Thursday, December 9th, and also Saturday, December 11th, holiday hoopla events continue. Santa will hear children's wish lists at his New River Place Plaza workshop during Cedar Falls Holiday Hoopla from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday and 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday. Trolley rides will be available too. Sample and vote on unique drinks concocted by participating establishments during the Hoopla Cheer Contest from 6 to 9:30 p.m. Thursday. An ugly sweater contest is from 9:30 to 10 o'clock p.m. Thursday at Burke's Main Street Pub, 207 Main Street in Cedar Falls. Also on Thursday, December 9th, Local Legend Series present Stackhouse. Stackhouse will rock out with a hint of country on favorite Christmas tunes as they introduce their long-awaited release, Everywhere I Turn, It's Christmas, at 7 p.m. Thursday at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. You can catch it virtually, too. Also, beginning on Thursday, December 9th, and continuing through Sunday, December 12th, find your holiday spirit with Elf. In Elf, the musical, Buddy says the best way to spread holiday cheer is singing loud so everyone can hear. While you probably shouldn't sing along, at least not too loudly. Audiences are loving Waterloo Community Playhouse's production of this hit musical. Shows continue Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7 p.m. and 2 p.m. on Sunday at Hope Martin Theater in the Waterloo Center for the Arts, 225 Commercial Street. Adults are $25. Students are $15. Order tickets online at www.wcpbhct.org or at area code 319-291-4494 or at the box office. Now on Friday and Saturday, December 10th and the 11th, Pearl Harbor Living History at Veterans Museum. On Friday and Saturday, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., an immersive Pearl Harbor 80th Anniversary Storytelling event takes place at the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum, 503 South Street. Actors will convey stories from veterans and others during the December 7, 1941 attack, free with the price of admission. Next, Christmas in Babylon, not typical holiday fare. Terry McShane is a blue-collar guy from Babylon, Long Island. Out of the blue, he is contacted by his ex-fiancée and learned he has a daughter that he never knew about. A troupe of local actors, including Joe and Anne Frenna, with director Grant Tracy, will present the play at the Music Hill Studios, 1509 Rainbow Drive, Waterloo. Performances are 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Seating is limited. Tickets are $10, available at musichillstudios.com or at the door. On Friday, December 10th, and through Sunday, December 12th, take a walk on the bright side. House of Hope's Festival of Lights is from 5 to 9 p.m. Friday through Saturday at Lost Island KOA, 4550 Hess Road, Waterloo. Stroll through a winter wonderland of lights, listen to Christmas music by local performers, and warm up with cocoa and a cookie. Stick around for Santa and the festive surprises. Tickets are $20 per vehicle at houseofhopeccd.charityproud.org. Proceeds will benefit House of Hope programs. Season's greetings from CFTS's Plaid Tidings. The beloved Forever Plaid Quartet has returned to Earth for an encore appearance in Plaid Tidings, presented by Cedar Falls Community Theater at the Oster Regent Theater. Performances are at 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday and 2 o'clock p.m. on Sunday. Order tickets at osterregent.com or call 319-277-5283 or visit the box office from 1 to 5 p.m. Mondays through Friday and 1 hour before the show. Tickets are $30 for adults, $10 for students. On Saturday, December 11th, Met Chorale to perform Handel's Messiah. Metropolitan Chorale celebrates its return to the stage with a concert Saturday at 3 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church, 505 Franklin Street in Waterloo. They will perform Handel's Messiah, a holiday favorite. Artistic director is Amy Katsonis. Tickets are $15 for adults, $25 for families, and free for students with a school ID. Now we're up to Sunday, December 12th, Bel Canto Cedar Valley to perform concert. Bel Canto Cedar Valley will perform their annual holiday concert at 2 p.m. Sunday at the Hearst Center for the Arts, 304 West Surly Boulevard in Cedar Falls, and Cedar River Readers to present Polar Express. Hartman Reserve Nature Center will host a Reader's Theater performance of the beloved holiday classic Polar Express, featuring the Cedar River Readers. The event is from 2 to 3 p.m. Sunday at 657 Reserve Drive in Cedar Falls. Santa will make a special appearance. There is no cost, but registration is required at blackhawk-countyparks.com. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, December 6th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. As there are no obituaries posted in today's paper, let's continue reading local news and opinion. The Associated Press filed this story: Grand Ole Opry singer Stonewall Jackson dies at 89. And the story begins with a photograph of country music veteran Stonewall Jackson performing on the stage of the Raymond Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville, Tennessee. Country musician Stonewall Jackson, who sang on the Grand Ole Opry for more than 50 years and had number one hits with Waterloo and others, died Saturday after a long battle with vascular dementia. He was 89. The Opry, the longest-running radio show in history, announced Jackson's death in a news release. Jackson, a guitarist, performed on the Opry beginning in 1956 and was still appearing on the show in 2010. His real name was Stonewall, after Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. According to WSMV-TV, the late Porter Wagner would introduce Stonewall on his show by saying he came to the Opry with a heart full of love and a sack full of songs. Waterloo was a hit on the country and pop charts in 1959. His other hits, mostly in the 1960s, included Don't Be Angry, BJ the DJ, Why I'm Walkin', A Wound Time Can't Erase, and I Washed My Hands in Muddy Water. In 1971, he recorded his version of Lobo's Me and You and a Dog Named Boo. Over the course of his career, Jackson landed 44 singles on the Billboard Country Chart. In 2008, at the age of 75, he settled a federal age discrimination lawsuit against the Opry. He claimed Opry officials had cut back his appearances starting in 1998 and sought $10 million in compensatory damages and $10 million in punitive damages. Terms of the settlement were not disclosed. Jackson was born in eastern North Carolina and was raised on a South Georgia farm. Jackson's mentor in his early career was country legend Ernest Tubb, who bought him his first stage clothes and hired him as his opening act. He was presented with the Ernest Tubb Memorial Award in 1997 for his contributions to country music, according to the Grand Ole Opry website. In 1991, he privately published his autobiography, From the Bottom Up. And now let's turn to the commentary page for an opinion column Numbers suggest another COVID surge as Iowans' vaccinations lag, filed by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau. These are not warning signs. They are bright red, blaring alarms. We're headed for another COVID-19 wave this winter in Iowa and in many parts of the country, unless things get turned around soon. And that sure is a difficult thing to justify with the availability of vaccines. COVID-related hospitalizations in Iowa surged past 700 this week, according to state public health data. That is, shockingly, the highest number of COVID hospitalizations since almost exactly 1 year ago, when we were just coming down from the pandemic's most deadly surge. Between then and now, hospitalizations plummeted as the vaccine became more available and people were able to more often get outside where the virus does not spread as well. By July, the number of COVID hospitalizations statewide was no more than a few dozen. Over the past 3 months, however, that number has steadily climbed again, despite the widespread availability of three COVID-19 vaccines, all of which have proven remarkably effective at keeping people out of the hospitals, even among the vaccinated who experience breakthrough cases. In other words, there's really no reason that hospitalization numbers should be shooting up like it is, but it is. And hospitals and healthcare workers are getting uneasy again. The silver lining is that COVID-19-related deaths are not surging the same way hospitalizations are. Obviously, that is fantastic news, and again, likely a credit to the vaccines. But preventing death is not the vaccine's only benefit. They also, as previously stated, excel at keeping people out of the hospital. When COVID-19 patients start packing the hospitals, like they are starting to once again, other health care services suffer. It's not just the COVID-19 patients that are put in harm's way. It's all the other people who need health care and don't get it fast enough because the hospitals are full of COVID patients. That can lead to serious illness or even deaths that do not show up in the COVID data, but are, for all intents and purposes, COVID-related. Every serious public health official and infectious disease expert continues to say the same thing. The best way to limit COVID's spread and destruction is to get vaccinated. It's not happening fast enough in Iowa. Only 61% of Iowans 5 years and older, those who are eligible for the vaccines, are fully vaccinated, according to federal data. That's right down the middle, 25th among U.S. states and Washington, D.C. Even the 12 and up population, which has been eligible for nearly a year, only made it to 67%. The entire state is experiencing the largest level of COVID transmission, according to federal data, and only 3 out of 5 Iowans are vaccinated against the virus that continues to rage. I'll wager a paycheck that you're sick and tired of hearing about COVID. It doesn't matter whether you were first in line to get the vaccine or have been a skeptic since day one of the pandemic. COVID fatigue unites us all. Fortunately, there is a solution, vaccination. Add a booster shot and some thoughtful mask wearing on the side, and you have a recipe for a much healthier and safer and less deadly winter. Unfortunately, at the rate Iowans are getting vaccinated, we may be headed in the other direction. Numbers do not lie, but they do scare, at least they should. Next is an opinion filed by Steve Corbin. Anti-voting laws spark petition drive. 13 months ago, the 2020 federal election drew America's highest voter turnout, 66.7%, in more than a century. It is alleged the former President Donald Trump and some Republican diehards attempted a coup at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th to overturn the Electoral College process and place the loser as president. Ever since that election, lawmakers from 44 states have tinkered with the election process with some positive and negative results. Legislators from 25 states enacted 62 laws to expand voting access. These politicians were responding to Americans' eagerness to vote by making it easier for eligible voters to cast their ballots. And the source listed here is Brennan Center for Justice, October 4th. Sadly, 19 states enacted 33 laws making it harder for citizens to vote. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Montana, Nevada, New Hampshire, New York, Oklahoma, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming. 10 pro-democracy organizations in Iowa appear to be the first in the nation to have formed a coalition and are saying enough is enough regarding Iowa's GOP-controlled House, Senate, and governor enacting anti-voter laws in the spring of 2021. They are taking their case to Iowa voters in hopes of presenting a petition with their signatures to the leaders of Iowa's 89th General Assembly. Iowa's new legislative session begins on January 10th. The petition is requesting legislators to repeal sections SF-413 and SF-568 from the newly enacted voting law. In summary, the groups contend Iowa's law makes voting harder, disqualifies voters easier, shortens voting time period by 31%, makes election more difficult to administer, and invites political party interference in election. The Alliance maintains the net effect of Iowa's new voting law related to sections SF-413 include shortening the time period to apply for a mail ballot, shortening the deadline to deliver mail ballots, eliminating the sending of mail ballot applications to voters who do not specifically request the forms, restricting assistance to return a voter's mail ballot, limiting the number, location, or availability of mail ballot drop boxes, reducing polling place availability, and limiting early voting days and hours. Section SF-568 of Iowa's new voting law is opposed by the consortium as it restricts assistance in returning a voter's mail ballot and it increases barriers for voters with disabilities. Therese Grant, president of the League of Women Voters of Iowa, believes Iowa's new voting law disenfranchises voters and is an attempt to disqualify voters and restrict the constitutional right to vote. Quote, defending democracy has been our motto since our founding in 1920, and we have always supported an open and transparent government, including the right to vote, said Grant. She continued, quote, democracy works best when more people, not fewer, are involved. The petition drive to repeal sections SF-413 and SF-568 is one way in which Iowans can get involved and let their duly elected legislators know their opposition to Iowa's new imposed anti-voter law. LWVIA's petition to repeal anti-voter laws has co-sponsors including Episcopal Diocese of Iowa, Common Good Iowa, Iowa chapters of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, Iowa Shares, Des Moines Chapter, The Lynx, Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Sierra Club Iowa Chapter. The U.S. House of Representatives has already passed the Freedom to Vote Act and John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Both acts are before the Senate and will protect racial and minority voting rights, reform campaign financing, and establish a commonplace voting standard in all 50 states. Urging senators to approve these acts would eliminate state legislators from 19 states playing games with citizens' cherished right to vote. Steve Corbin is an emeritus professor of marketing at the University of Northern Iowa and former Denver Board of Education member. The opinions expressed in this article are those of the author and do not reflect those of the University of Northern Iowa. And now we have an opinion piece from Dave Nagel, who is a Waterloo attorney and a former U.S. congressman. A novel idea for the holiday season. We know when the Christmas season commences at the Nagel household, the newly arrived Advent calendars now sit on top of the kitchen table, each day marked by tasty small bar of chocolate candy, a different flavor for each day between now and December 25th. Advent calls for celebration as we direct our thoughts and prayers to the anniversary of the birth of our Lord. The days generate a spirit of charity and the warmth of friendship in the family. Truly a special time. But as a society, we could really make this a unique moment in the nation's history if we did something that, to my knowledge, no one else has ever suggested. Let us do Lent at the same time. Now Lent is known as almost the opposite of Advent. It is 40 days long, recognizing the period when Jesus Christ wandered in the desert in preparation for his ministry, and is completed by Easter Sunday. The time is marked by reflection, atonement, and sacrifice. In fact, among churchgoers who practice the religions that honor these days, the most frequently asked question is, "What are you giving up for Lent?" Depending on the personal desires of the individual Christian, the Lenten sacrifice can be anything from a favorite food to a treasured activity. Therefore, it makes sense to combine Christmas and Easter celebrations this year. This will become crystal clear when I suggest what we should give up. With the deep fall now upon us, I have again taken up watching TV news shows, almost all of them including Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. I also try to catch the top news stories on CBS, NBC, and ABC. It is particularly interesting when it happens to see different broadcasts report on the same news story. In almost all cases, each show attempts to convince the viewer that the incident they are covering is, undoubtedly, the most important happening in Congress or by the administration this year, if not since the commencement of this century. What I can't quite figure out is whether it is the competition between these news shows that causes the hyping of relatively modest developments, or the need to retain or maybe slightly expand their existing viewer base. What I do know is that they all seem to delight in picking the most conservative or liberal commentator to pontificate about the importance of the event. These observations are routinely given in very strident tones. So here is my suggestion. Turn off the news and current events shows until January 2nd, 2022. We enjoy Advent, and we give up something we don't enjoy or need in our sacrifice for Lent. You need not worry that you will miss something, because I can personally guarantee that on the first day or the first month of the new year, we will all be told what we learned in the second week of the Biden presidency. The president is a failure, senile, and no meaningful legislation is going to pass Congress. The Republicans are hypocritical in refusing to fund the government or assist in raising the limit on debt former President Trump helped create. Our governor will continue to praise nursing home workers who stood up for their freedom while having COVID and infecting their patients. We will still be talking about reforming education, inflation, and immigration. There is something deeper about our current situation. We have a responsibility as citizens to become informed and cast intelligent ballots. We do not have to accept news presented to us in such a partisan manner. If, when we return to the news channels after our Lenten vacation, we follow those outlets that provide balance in the reporting current events, when those who are doing the presenting will notice and perhaps modify their approach. We also, as a free society, need to calm down and accept the fact that modern journalists have not been, particularly in television, fulfilling their responsibility in the real function and purpose of the Fourth Estate, which is to report the news fairly and accurately. Happy holidays, including Easter. On the national news page, third party to probe school actions before shooting, filed by the Associated Press, Pontiac, Michigan. A third party will investigate events at Oxford High School that occurred before a school shooting that left four students dead and six other students and a teacher wounded. The Michigan District Superintendent said, with the Michigan Attorney General responding Sunday, that her office could conduct it. Oxford Community Schools Superintendent Tim Throne said in a statement that he called for the outside investigation because parents have asked questions about the school's version of events leading up to the shooting. He also elaborated on interactions with the student leading up to the shooting. Quote, "It's critically important to the victims, our staff, and our entire community that a full and transparent accounting be made," Throne said. His comments came after a news conference Friday by Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald that detailed numerous warning signs from the student charged in the shooting. His search for gun ammunition on a cell phone and a drawing that showed a bullet with the words "blood everywhere" above a person who appears to have been shot, along with "my life is useless" and "the world is dead," unquote. Quote, "Of course he shouldn't have gone back to that classroom. I believe that is a universal position. I'm not going to chastise or attack, but yeah," McDonald said. On Tuesday at the school, roughly 30 miles north of Detroit, the student was sent back to the classroom after a school meeting with his parents. 3 hours later, the shooting occurred. Quote, "The school should have been responsible to relay that to the sheriff's office. It looks like this could have been prevented," Robert Jordan, founder and director of St. Louis-based Protecting Our Students, said Friday. Quote, "People died because of those mistakes," unquote. The suspect in the Oxford High shooting, Ethan Crumbly, 15, is now charged as an adult with murder, terrorism, and other crimes. On Friday, prosecutors charged his parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, with 4 counts of each of involuntary manslaughter. They pleaded not guilty on Saturday, and a judge imposed a combined $1 million bond. Let's turn now to the sports page and read from the area roundup. Cedar Falls takes 4th in swim meet. And this story is filed by Hart Pisani. The Cedar Falls boys swim team swam their way to a 4th-place finish at the Mike Whitmer Invitational at Ames High School on Saturday. Sophomore John Butler had the top individual result for the Tigers as he took 4th place in the 500 freestyle with a time of 5 minutes, 4.24 seconds. Cedar Falls also had a relay team of Graham Fry, Butler, Drew, Wagner, and Cole Wilson take 4th in the 400 freestyle relay with a time of 3 minutes, 26.77. In wrestling, DNH takes 3rd at Bob Murphy Invite. Dyke New Hartford is going home from the Bob Murphy Invitational as 3rd-place finishers. Zach Aldemund at 195 and Nick Reinecke at 182 were the top finishers as they took home 1st place in their respective weight classes. 10 of DNH's 11 wrestlers ended up placing. Central Springs takes 2nd at Chris David Invite. The Panthers finished the invite with a team score of 159.5. Second only to Nashua Plainfield's 199.5. 10 of their 12 wrestlers placed as Bryce McDonald at 145 and Clayton McDonald at 138. Both took home 1st place individually. Waterloo West nearly sweeps Jessup Dual Tournament. The Wahawks went 4-1 with wins over AGWSR, which is 42-37, Jessup 46-34, and North Tampa 45-24, and Postville 72-12. Their lone loss came to Regina 48-30. As for the host Jayhawks, they went 2-3 on Saturday. Their wins came against Postville at 48-36 and Regina at 48-39, while they fell to North Tama 40-24. AGWSR at 48-36 and West. Boys basketball, Waterloo West 65, Columbus Catholic 29. The Wahawks started their season off on the right foot with a convincing win Friday night. The result was never in question as West already led 32-8 by midway point and never looked back. West didn't post individual stats after the game. Columbus Catholic was led by Ben Trost, 11 points. Xavier 50, Waverly Shell Rock 45. The Gohawks played well enough to win for much of the game, but a dreadful showing in the second quarter ended up being the difference maker. WSR was outscored 16-4 in the second period and couldn't complete the comeback despite outscoring Xavier in the second half. No stats were available for this game. North Tama 66, Waterloo Christian 62. The Regents lost a close one to Red Hawks, though no scoring summary by quarter was made available. Drew Wagner had an impressive game for Waterloo Christian with 22 points and 11 rebounds. Bryce Adams at 18 points and Aaron Zweck at 14 points also had outstanding efforts. In girls basketball, Waterloo West 68, Johnsburg 46. The Wahawks went all the way to Illinois to give Johnsburg the business as they got out to a 37-19 halftime lead and never looked back. All four starters reached the double-figure scoring mark, but who those starters were wasn't known at press time, and no stats were put online. WSR 33, Xavier 31. What looked like a runaway heading into the fourth quarter ended up being a nail-biter, but the Gohawks ultimately came out on top. Waverly led 28-16 leading into the fourth, but were outscored 15-5 and had to fight to hold on at that point. No stats were available for this game. Waterloo Christian 58, North Tama 36. The Regents once again rolled to victory with a little trouble as they currently sit at 4-0. They had little trouble taking down the Red Hawks as Katie Costello led the way with 19 points and 9 boards. Regan Wheeler, 16 points, 8 rebounds, and Allison White, 11 points and 7 rebounds, also had strong efforts for the Waterloo Christian. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, December 6th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.